welcome to Cloud Native Startup. I'm Emily Omir, your host, and today I am chatting with co-founder of Portainer, Neil Kressfeld. Neil, thank you so much for joining me.
It's awesome to be here with you.
So the first thing I wanted to have you do actually is just a give. This is going to be really hard, I know, but give sort of a short introduction to your long and very interesting career, particularly, you know, how you first started out as in self-employment and then how that has evolved to founding Portainer.
Wow. How long have you got? Okay, so
cliff notes, just the cliff notes.
Okay, so I started out my career very young. I actually started in IT when I was 17. I worked for a small IT company here in New Zealand. I was headhunted and worked into IBM when I was 18, and basically worked with IBM for 13 years, which taught me how to be a consultant, how to be an engineer, how to understand the needs of enterprise IT very well. I then jumped out of IBM into self-employment and basically worked with a crew of people building a VMware consulting practice. That practice grew out of New Zealand into Australia, into Asia. That had me fly up to Singapore and live in Singapore for a number of years as a consultant working with VMware, addressing the top 150 organizations that are in VMware's top tier portfolio. That whole career really gave me deep insights into the needs of a CIO, CTO, and has let me be a really high-flying consultant for quite some time. I then pivoted and decided I wanted to be in customer land for a while, and I jumped out and became the CEO of a cloud provider based in Indonesia, which was amazing because up until that time in my career, I had consulted but never actually run any of the environments that I had consulted on. But this time, I was the architect of the platform for the cloud provider that I then joined as the CEO. And that was eye-opening to see true changes in day-to-day operations. So how the challenges and struggles that a CIO and a CTO go through every single day to keep a platform up and operational and delivering to SLAs. And that changed me forever.
And then how did this lead to Portainer?
So when I was at that cloud provider, I wanted to deliver a container as a service offering to the market. Now, this was now 4 years ago and maybe even longer. I mean, it was very, very early in the days of Docker at that time. There was no Kubernetes then. It was just Docker. And I'm like, okay, cool. This technology looks pretty awesome. I can see it's going to change the world. How can I deliver a container as a service offering to the market? So I went about and built this amazing service. It basically was an API endpoint. And I said to customers, here you go. Here is your API endpoint. Here are your TLS keys to authenticate. Have at it. And no one knew what I was talking about. No one knew how to engage with it. No one knew how to deploy containers. No one knew what they were. And I saw the real need for a layer of UI to help simplify the onboarding into container native technologies. So to take organizations who have never seen or heard of containers before, have had no real exposure to deploying into this type of platform, and guide them on that journey. You know, so to speak, a on-ramp experience or a bootstrap. And so set about building Portainer for myself, for my own cloud provider first, to say, well, how can we take customers, bring them into a portal, and guide them on the journey to deploy applications and containers? And that's how Portainer came about. It's since evolved and morphed a lot and really, really focused now on internal IT and how internal IT can actually deliver a container as a service.
And what was the moment when you decided that you were going to leave the Indonesian cloud provider and just do Portainer on as its own thing?
3 years ago, I think, was that point. No, it wasn't. It was about almost 4 years ago, actually. And that was when I started to see the downloads of Portainer skyrocket. So again, it was designed as an internal tool. And so therefore, it's like, okay, well, this is a tool for me. I'm going to open source it. If people want to use it, they can use it. It doesn't really matter. And then I think it was Christmas of 2016, we ended up getting 1 million downloads of Bulletainer, and it was like, wow, that's crazy. There's a lot of people out there like this thing. And so I actually spun it out as a separate entity and said, okay, well, here it is over here. It's now going to be a separate company called Bulletainer. The company is going to basically be the managing entity for the project called Bulletainer, and we're just going to let it go, and I'll spend a bit of my time doing Bulletainer and see how we go. And I moved back to New Zealand for other reasons as well, but at the same time decided to really, really focus on Bulletainer at the same time.
And so by the time you decided that Portainer might become its own commercial entity, it was already like a fairly thriving open source project.
Well, we only really decided that it would become a commercial viability 2 years ago. And at that point, we cracked the 2 billion downloads of the product, which is a simply ridiculous number to even comprehend. And we started getting inbound connections from some very, very large organizations saying, hey, we're using Portainer and we'd really like to see you adding this kind of feature. And we're like, well, hang on a second. This was way outside the realms of what the project was ever designed for. It was really designed to help people get started, and corporates actually using this thing in mission critical production as a way to circumvent the need to retrain all their staff was completely what it's designed to do, but not who it was originally designed for. So there was a real need to say, well, actually, to exist in very large corporate or even exist in commercial use, it needs to have some other things in it. It needs to have better compliance, better security, better governance. There needs to be other things added to it. So at that point, we said, well, actually, this thing looks like it's got some commercial legs. Let's spin it off as a true commercial entity. Let's get funding for it, and let's try and build this thing into something real.
And who would you say it was originally built for?
It was originally built for those just getting started with containers. And by that, what I meant really was startups who were trying to deploy net new cloud native applications. You see, back in the back, 400 bit years ago, Docker wasn't really that good at legacy applications. They hadn't yet perfected data persistence and networking and clustering. So it was really a cool piece of software that worked if you had cloud native applications that could scale out and be resilient within the application. As time progressed and the Docker product got better and Docker started to focus much more on modernizing legacy applications, the use case for Docker technologies went much wider, and so therefore Portainer's use case went much wider. And still today, now you've got Docker stateless, Docker stateful legacy applications, and Kubernetes use cases, and Portainer spans all of those. So now our use case is very, very wide.
And when you made that decision and realized that this may become a commercial entity, what was your first steps to make that a reality?
First steps were trying to figure out how we would support the community. The moment that you decide to make something commercial, people expect things like support. They expect to be able to engage with a company and that company to be professional and have proper, tax registration numbers. They can do their IR 86, US government tax obligation forms. And I was like, okay, well, if we can't just all of a sudden turn around tomorrow and start selling a product, we need to understand how we deal with tax liability, how we're going to support our user base. And so we immediately had to start scaling the business to say, well, actually, now we need to get a support team so we can deliver SLAs. We need to radically increase our level of QA. Because as an open source product, if you release a version and there's bugs, man, what happens? Not really much. When you are a commercial entity, if you release a product with bugs, you've got some pretty serious brand damage to deal with. So we had to elevate the level of product QA, product support. And then once we had that right, then we started going backwards and saying, okay, now we need to increase the number of devs so we can iterate faster. But also we had to, for the first time ever, start really building a 2-3 year roadmap for what we wanted to build. Now, previously, we just built what we thought was needed based on feedback. Now we're like, well, actually, now we need to think about a 3 year plan or two to 3 year plan to say, well, where are we going to engage our dev resources? What features do we want to build? Why do we want to build them? Will this actually help our users go faster? Will it help us be more commercially viable? There's a whole bunch of dimensions.
And what was your first step in terms of like trying to charge money for Portainer. What was your first commercial offering? And how did you decide what would be your first commercial offering?
Well, there's actually a large number of people who have attempted to monetize open source products. And it's pretty tried and proven. And that is you sell support. So the open source product is completely free. And the way that you monetize is by charging for support, which is all well and good, except if your product is actually pretty reliable and you already give pretty good free support to the open source community. It becomes very difficult to sell support if your support for free is already good enough. So you then have to make a hard decision. Do I now give terrible support to my open source community in order to sell them support? And I just couldn't do that. I didn't want to do that. We had become quite famous for not only being a product, but a product that gave amazing support to our free and open community. So it's like, well, I can't commercialize support. I tried and it didn't work. I tried to actually commercialize support. And then we said, okay, well, are there any distinct pieces of functionality that we could actually commercialize as an extension or a plugin into the open source product? And we did that. We said, well, here are three features which we'll charge for. And in the free open source products, you can click add plugin and you can go and download and install a closed source plugin. And that actually worked really, really well. We just got critiqued for taking an open source product and making it kind of hybrid. Is it open source or is it proprietary? So then we said, okay, well, actually, we're going to embrace this new paradigm called commercial open core. And so what that means is that we have an open core product, which is the Portainer Community Edition, and then we have a closed source proprietary version, which we call Portainer Business. So we went through three different iterations until we got that right to say, well, how are we going to monetize this? And the whole open core model is now what we've settled on.
And stepping back just a tiny bit, I'm actually curious if you can sort of look back and think, like, what did you do to make Portainer, the open source project, so popular? It can be easy to say, you know, oh, it just took off, but it's probably, you're probably not being fair to yourself. There's probably something that you did right to make that happen.
I believe that there were three elements to our success in the open source product. All three of them based on just sheer hard work. We actually built a product that people wanted to use. We had an absolute maniacal focus on radically simplifying the whole experience. Many other people in our ecosystem came about creating similar products, but they were so focused on a one-to-one translation between the underlying technology's capability and their UI that it became just unwieldy. It was far too complicated. We said no to more features than we said yes, because it would have made the product too complicated. So we really, really said we want to focus on this niche called simplifying the whole container experience. And if any feature request comes in that would jeopardize our ability to make things simple and easy to understand, it got rejected. So we basically had an absolute maniacal focus on our core philosophy, which was simplifying the journey. The second thing is that we provided an absolutely amazing support experience to our open source community. We were living and breathing Docker every single day. We knew it really, really well. We had a large number of users, and so we actively engaged in the general Docker community, and we helped people triage and troubleshoot issues that they had, and at the same time signing off Neil at Portainer. So people knew who it was that was helping them, even though I was helping them with issues completely unrelated to Portainer. But I would sign off with just a little comment, hey, if you're using Portainer, this would have been way easier. And that just dragged people, oh, what's this thing? They dragged and followed in. And I think the last thing was we just absolutely lived inside social media. So inside social media, we were actively promoting the product, heavily promoting. Really early on, we jumped onto the whole Docker influencer type ecosystem. The things called Docker captains, or the guys called Docker captains. These people are the most respected people in the Docker ecosystem, and we kind of piggybacked onto them and said, hey, look, this is Portainer. Is there anything we can do to help you understand better, more about our product? Can you help us spread the word about Portainer and how easy it is to use this underlying technology with Portainer? So we jumped onto those micro influencers and said, help us spread the word. So they were the three things.
Excellent. If you were to talk to somebody who was working on an open source project that they aspired to have, you know, 1 million downloads over Christmas at some point, what would your recommendations be? And including, like, what mistakes did you make that you would advise somebody to not make?
So a lot of people think that by open sourcing your product, you get free developers helping you build your product. And that's simply not the case. The biggest benefit from open source is not that you'll have people writing your code for you. The biggest benefit is that you'll get users of the product telling you about bugs and opening feature requests. So they will tell you what's wrong and they'll tell you what's missing. It's very, very rare that you'll get people actually saying, and here's the code to make this a better product. It's very rare. And a lot of people open source their product in the blind assumption that they're simply going to get hundreds of devs saying, hey, I really like your product. Here is some code for a new feature. That just doesn't happen. The second thing is understand your long-term goals for the project, because before it becomes a product in a company, it starts off as a project. And we when we started out with Bortana, never really had any intention of commercializing this thing. It was just this fun thing on the side over here. And so we made some decisions that have made it much harder for us further down the line to turn it from a project further down the line to turn it from a project to a product, to be clear and honest with yourself. Do you plan to commercialize this in the future? And if so, it may change how you make some decisions with the product from day one.
Excellent. And how has your experience as a consultant influenced how you run your product company now? And in general, in fact, how you approach running a company or, you know, approaching customers and that sort of thing?
Well, I've spent many, many years sitting in the office of the CIO and the CTO and understanding what makes them tick, what their requirements are, how they are accountable to their CEO and to their company's board for IT. And when IT was just a cost center, the CIO was told, make sure the system stays up, make sure it stays up as cheap as possible. Now that IT has kind of morphed into more of a center of innovation and a enabler for the business to do better things, it's far more dynamic now. The CIO was told, how can you provide a platform that will let us get a new digital product out the door faster, more reliable, more predictable? And so that whole time spent in the office of these two people has given me now an inbuilt DNA knowledge to say, this is how a product that is going to be adopted at scale must behave. You can't take a product into enterprise. You can't take a product into the office of a CIO if it's missing these core features. So from our perspective, we've been really, really focused on saying, how do we backfill these missing features that make it a viable product in the eyes of a CIO, CTO? And again, how do we make Bortana operate as a product that a CIO can say, I want to adopt Kubernetes tomorrow, and all of my 2,000 developers today who do not know anything about Kubernetes must be able to start building applications that run on Kubernetes tomorrow. And ordinarily, that would be impossible. You have to go and retrain the staff. And you know, we've got a real focus to say, how can Bortana bridge that gap so any existing dev, regardless of their current knowledge of containers or Kubernetes in general, can actually use Bortana and go. So that's helped me a lot with the whole product market fit. So knowing through instinct what's required through our time spent with the CIO and CTO.
Mm-hmm. And in fact, it strikes me, unlike a lot of founders that I talk to, you've almost, since you were the CEO of a cloud service provider, you have been the person that you are selling to.
Absolutely. I am my own worst customer. My product team think I'm brutal just because of the way that I critique their work. I'm like, no, I don't like this. No, change it. There's no way I can release that. I say to them often, I wouldn't buy that. So if I wouldn't buy that, why would anyone out there in our user base buy it? So go back and change it. So I'm quite brutal that way. So I am definitely our worst customer. I think that's actually the benefit of being a slightly older founder. I've actually spent my time out there, being out in customer land. I've been a consultant. I've been a customer. I understand the needs. It's made it slightly easier, I think.
What would you say are the main differences between being a consultant, being the CEO of a service provider, of a cloud service provider, and being the co-founder of Kubernetes or containers product company?
To be fair, a consultant is quite ego-driven, quite perfectionist. So, as a consultant, you want to build the very, very best solution you possibly can, and you want to be very, very proud of the solution that you have designed and have had built. Now, that's all well and good, but what happens if you've built a system that's so perfect, it's crazy complicated, and the customer can't actually manage it? So, a week in, a month in, 2 months in, the whole thing falls over because the customer for which you actually designed the solution for cannot get their heads around the platform that you've now handed to them, and the thing falls over. That's a really failed consulting engagement. And so many consultants forget about day two operations, and they're focused solely on building the very best thing they can on day one, signing off their scope of work and exiting. So, from a consultant perspective, it's all about day one. A CIO, CEO is all about day two. How do you, now that you've got this thing, how do you make this thing resilient? How do you turn it into a commercially viable offering?
And how is that then different from what you're doing now? And in fact, I should phrase this a little differently, which is, what have you had to learn at Portainer that you didn't have to learn in your previous roles?
Software engineering is something quite new to me. So, I am not a developer. I'm an infrastructure person. I know VMware and storage. Writing software was something very foreign to me. So, luckily, my co-founder happened to be a developer, and so helped me on that journey. As we've progressed, we've had to bring in additional expertise to say, let's go and build a global, software development practice. Without software development, Portainer is basically nothing but a good idea. And so we needed to have a very, very scalable, dynamic product engineering team to go and actually develop the product. And that was something very, very new to me.
Interesting. That's like almost the opposite of most founders that I talk with.
Yeah. Crazy, huh?
Yeah, it's always good to know that you can kind of come at this from any direction and be successful.
I wouldn't say it's easy. Learning software development and software development disciplines is quite intriguing. I tend to oversimplify things in my brain. So I see a feature request and I'm like, oh yeah, that's probably a week's worth of work. Comes back from the dev team, no, that's a month worth of work, and here's all the QA overhead required for it. It's like, whoa, didn't see that coming. So yeah, I suppose as you get more seasoned or more experienced with the whole requirements of software development, you start to get a better understanding. I'm now much better. My team don't get so frustrated with me in regards to, I want this feature and I want it in 3 days.
And what would you say in terms of turning Portainer the project into Portainer the business? What were some mistakes that you made? And like, what would you tell yourself if you could go back in time to that decision a couple years ago to make that jump? What advice do you wish you could have heard that maybe could have allowed you to jump over some of your pitfalls?
So you have to be very careful that you don't build an open source product that is so good, is so feature rich, that nobody sees the need to move into the paid version. In the early days, we just wanted the open source product to be the best it could possibly be. And so we just threw every single feature at the thing. And then when it came time to actually commercialize, it's like, well, if we need to have some features that are paid for features, what are those? And in the open source version, we had so much capability. It's like, well, man, it's quite difficult to come up with some features that we can add to that aren't sort of shotgunned approach. We need to have a real strategy that says this particular area of the product we will only deliver through our commercial version. Everything else is open source. Is it only security? Is it only compliance? Is it only HA and replication? What are the particular features that we're going to now exclude from the open source product to have only the business product? In the early days, we just threw everything at the open source product because that was the only thing we had, and it made it very difficult to come up with features that we needed to add to make it separately commercially viable. So that was probably the biggest challenge.
And in fact, how does that sort of relate to this idea of trying to keep it, extremely simple as possible? How do you even add new feature or like add more features for your commercial product and still ensure that it's super simple?
We spend so much time in our product team understanding the user experience, the user journey. So when we want to add a feature, it would actually we could probably add features 3 times faster than we are now if we weren't so focused on retaining the level of user simplicity. We spend so much time, debating the merits of the UX. How can we add this feature? Where does this input box need to be? What's the actual terminology that we need to put in front of this input box to get information? What kind of validation do we need to do when they put data into the input box to make sure that they're only inputting data that we actually need and not incorrect data? So we spend a crazy amount of time on the front end UI UX to make sure that the feature is as simple as it can possibly be, which makes things slower. Clearly we go slower than if we were just passing a raw feature through. But that's just the nature. We cannot and will never compromise on our core ethos of making it simple. And that just means that by the very virtue of that, we either go slower or we need more devs to go at a speed than if we didn't.
What are you struggling with now?
Trying to understand the new market. Obviously, the container market is evolving at breakneck speed. What was good a year ago is not good anymore. Kubernetes came in and completely dominated away from Docker's Docker Swarm Orchestrator. Automation and GitOps was a thing that people thought would come into fruition 2023, 2024, and we're actually seeing it become pretty widely adopted now. Automation has definitely been fast-tracked quite substantially. The way that you manage Kubernetes environments, people originally assumed that you'd manage those the same way that you kind of manage Docker environments, and that's just not the case. Kubernetes is far more truly cloud native, and you need to manage it in a cloud native way. And so things were just got turbocharged as Kubernetes adoption skyrocketed, so too has change and innovation around it. And so we need to just go much, much faster and focus a lot more on the future. Otherwise you're always playing catch up. So we want to try and get in front of that wave by trying to predict where this rapidly evolving market is going to be in 12 months' time, 18 months' time, and start building for those features, for those needs, as opposed to building for today, because today is evolving so quickly.
And what do you see as the future? What are your best predictions for the overall ecosystem in 12 months?
So Kubernetes as a technology is staggeringly awesome. However, it remains overly complicated. Kubernetes is really the realm of a service provider. Service providers should be offering a Kubernetes service, and end users should simply say, "I want to take my application and deploy it." One of the things that I think will happen to Kubernetes is it'll turn into a like Google Cloud Run type experience, where you simply say, "Here's my application. I want it highly available." So therefore, spread it around every single data center or cloud platform that we can possibly have, just go do it and make it happen. And the platform says, "Okay, boss, I'll do that for you," and goes and understands and actually deploys it on behalf of. The end user should not have to know nor care about Kubernetes. Kubernetes should simply be the technology that underpins cloud offerings. And we're seeing that with Cloud Run. We're seeing that with Azure ACI. We see this a lot with the cloud providers now, simply saying, throw me your application and I'll take care of running it for you as I see fit on my global Kube platform.
Excellent. Well, just a couple more questions. My next question is actually just if you're based in New Zealand, and do you find that that matters? Like, does it matter where your company is based or not? I mean, have you found being in New Zealand to be an advantage or a disadvantage or just sort of neither?
It's a disadvantage to my sleep patterns. Most of our users are in US and Europe, which means that I'm often on 5 a.m. calls or 11 p.m. calls, which is highly disruptive. But other than that, not really. The internet has made the world, the internet has made the world just a single, yes, we have a large number of people working for us here in New Zealand, but that is not mandatory. People can work anywhere. So in that regards, access to talent, I don't think it matters where you are. It just matters from time zone. So, it's difficult when you're, fundamentally 12 hours inversed from your primary customers.
Yeah, fair enough. That has also been my experience. I often find myself describing my work as working with Silicon Valley startups, and then when I go back to think about it, realize that is not an accurate description, at least not a physical description of where most of the companies I work with are physically located. We're going to wrap up, and what is the best way for listeners to connect with you or follow you or learn more?
So I am 100% available at any time via email, and I've made it very easy. It's just neil@bultana.io. I respond to every single email that gets sent. So if people want to know more, they're free to email me. Otherwise, neil_cloud on Twitter is the other place, or just Neil Creswell on LinkedIn. So I am very, very open, and any feedback in regards to product or things that people think we're missing in the product, I'm open to any kind of feedback at all.
Fabulous. Well, thank you so much for joining me. This was an interesting conversation.
Oh, good. Appreciate the time.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Cloud Native Startup. If you'd like to learn more about positioning, messaging, and go-to-market for open source and cloud native startups, head over to my blog, positioningopensource.com. You can also join the conversation on Twitter. I'm at Emily O'Meara, and you can feel free to reach out on Twitter or on my website and blog with questions or comments. If you enjoyed this episode, also please share and help more people discover this podcast. Thank you, and we hope to have you next week.